Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be discussing in this episode are the top 300 trade sales through Diamond to retailers for March 2018. This includes hardcovers, softcovers, graphic novels, original graphic novels, digests, and frankly, whatever else they decide to put on the list that month. We've got not only the top 300, but the top 500, but when we do aggregates comparing it to months, we limit it to the top 300 since we've got that going back quite a ways. And obviously some of these trades and hardcovers are still sitting on store shelves, so we can buy them when we go to the stores. That's always a good thing. So with that, let's start by talking about the breakdown of the top 300.
Before you get started, John,
sure.
I just have a quick question. I'm not sure if you raised this with Sam. Do you think that the Diamond has gone to the extension of 500 because of so many DC and Marvel series having such low sales that there are so many, you know, so many of the quote unquote big two potentially fall under the top 300? Do you think that's why they're consistently giving 500 now?
I have no idea why they're giving the top 500. I think that's certainly a viable theory. There's just, I think, because of the increased frequency from both Marvel and DC, a lot of things coming out.
Gotcha. So it's just a total more amount of product. And so to get a better picture of the overall market, maybe 500 is better. I was just wondering in terms of, you know, remember how a couple years ago when Marvel would cancel anything that fell below 20,000 units, and now we look at that and laugh because that would be like half their line?
Yeah, well, I don't laugh. There's a little crying in there too, but I know exactly what you mean. But it was also a couple of years back when we were getting 400 items for a few months, and then they went back to 300.
Yeah, and I was more focused on like the comic side because that's where kind of like the most of the focus of the numbers on trades. It's a little bit harder because the honest truth, John, is that the vast majority of sales growth in the trade side is in the bookstore market. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of times sometimes when we talk about the trade numbers where we say, oh, this is kind of doing middling, but they may be selling 2, 3, 4, 10x the amount at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other bookstores, you know. So obviously, you know, on the comic side, the direct market is, you know, except for maybe 10% in Europe and UK, and then whatever the very few, Barnes & Noble racked extra dollar comics they sell, you know, those are, you know, infinitesimal small amounts. So it's kind of like, it's hard to make as many, you know, concrete judgments about the collected editions because there's such a market outside the direct market for those.
Well, between the bookstores you mentioned, convention sales, where I think a lot of trade sales are going to happen, and also libraries and such like that, oh, there's, I think, a larger readership of trades outside of these numbers.
Mm-hmm.
As to how much the sales difference is, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
Because, well, I mean, I think some of these, and I think with the mass market, it's very kind of lopsided. There are going to be certain things that do brilliantly over there and other things that may not even get in there, or if they do, practically everything that got in there gets returned.
Oh, absolutely. So like an example of that would be Raina Telgemeier does orders of magnitude more in the bookstore market and in the Scholastic book sales than she would in the direct market, like millions of dollars worth.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised, John, if at a certain point, if you add up Raina Telgemeier's books, she sells more copies than Robert Kirkman does and makes more money than Robert Kirkman. If you see the numbers from BookScan, she is moving millions of dollars of units of that stuff each year.
Well, this goes back to, I'm going to say, over 10 years ago when the Left Behind stuff mm-hmm. was coming out as graphic novels. They were alternating artists. Aaron Lopresti was one of the artists, and Jeff or Phil Moy, I forget what, which one, was the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I know both those guys. They're great guys. Actually, I know all three. I know Jeff and Phil, and I know Aaron. They're all great guys. But these were coming out through, I want to say Wildstorm might have been the one doing some of the stuff, but it was coming out mainly through religious bookstores because
mm-hmm.
it's a religious story about the rapture and stuff like that. And these things were doing gangbusters over there and were like virtually invisible in the direct market.
Yeah.
Just because of, again, the skew of the target demographic, the target audience there. And it's one of those things that for every one item or creator or property or whatever that's going to do just gangbusters outside in the direct market, I think there's going to be a large number, a multiple of that, that, man, they're just trying to get any kind of exposure or sales in that mass market.
Yeah. And the reason I kind of give an example of that is because on the 11 o'clock comics podcast in late February, early March, they had Jeff Lemire on. Mm-hmm. And he's a very prolific comics writer across many different companies, including Marvel, DC. And, you know, he does his own stuff. He has stuff at Valiant. And what they actually asked him about digital sales. And they said, you know, how it's really hard to get a handle on those sales. And is that increasing? Is it still a small slice? Where's your, you know, revenue coming from? And he would say, you know, and he can only speak for his numbers, but he does get those royalty sheets. And obviously they're broken down by where his books are selling. And he says, you know, digital is a small, but, you know, moderately growing to kind of, you know, it's kind of reached a plateau for him. But he says where the real growth is for him is in collected editions in the bookstore market. He says he sees for the last 5 years or so, we see double digit growth for his books in that market. Now, you know, Jeff Lemire is a top line writer. He publishes in all kinds of genres, superheroes, slice of life. You know, he does everything, indie, everything, right? And he publishes at like four or five publishers at a time. So you couldn't necessarily say that he's representative of your average comic creator, but, you know, that's where the growth is in a lot of the industry. And in fact, look at things like Astro City stopping singles, going to OGNs. Look at Oni Press, which has said that they're going to do a lot more OGNs and they're going to not be putting out things in print and single issues. They're just going to do either digital and collected editions. I think that there is going to be the segmentation of market where unless you have the capital to, you know, or a creator like Kirkman or Hickman who can use the money you've already made to subsidize books to get up to enough issues to have enough trades, I think a lot of the profitability is actually in the trades, especially outside the direct market. And that's going to become a very difficult thing for new creators to get through. Can I survive on single issue sales? Because look at some of these single issue sales at Image. They're so low that you can never get to a point where you can get your series to 30 issues, which is kind of what you need to get four or five trades out to get the economics of scale rolling downhill for you.
Well, there's a couple of things in what you said there. There's where is the area of growth, mm-hmm. and then where's the area of profit. Mm-hmm. And I want to split the two just a little bit. I certainly think there's a ton of growth potential in the trade market, certainly in the mass market side of it, mm-hmm. because I don't think the direct market is particularly huge or mm-hmm. even particularly large. So I think there's a ton of potential audience in the mass market that if creators can tap into, man, they've got such potential there. Mm-hmm. But profit-wise, that's a different thing because I think trades have an inherent advantage there because a lot, if not all, of the creative costs have already been paid for in the earlier versions if it's a collected edition.
Yep.
So if you can get to where those trades are doing well, I mean, that's a definite profit stream to be had there. And it's interesting because I think there are, again, some creators and some properties that are going to do well in a niche area like the direct market. Others are going to do better just because they've got a broader appeal. You know, mm-hmm. if you've got something that's tying into a movie, a TV show, or some other mass, you know, audience awareness kind of a thing, you've got a definite advantage there. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we look at the top 300, it bottoms out the top or the 300th item, 272 units. That's not particularly amazing.
Yeah.
You go all the way down to the end of the top 500 where we had a five-way tie at 165 units. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't take a whole lot to kind of beat out the sales on this in the mass market. And I think with the number of television shows, movies, video games, and just the general awareness of comic book-based properties, there's a definite, you know, possibility of if you can get the stuff into a Barnes & Noble or somewhere else that the mass market is, and let's face it, they don't generally go to comic stores, they're going to look at this stuff and they're going to be more open to it than they were 5, 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So on the teleconference we had last night as we record this, it was on April 14th, there was a lot of discussion around are trades going to become kind of that dominant revenue stream or not? And at one point, I was thinking they absolutely were, but that was like about 10 years ago, prior to digital being a factor. I think digital is a little bit of a wild card because it makes comics available to a much, much wider audience. Every cell phone, tablet, and computer is now a virtual comic book store, which is awesome. But it also lowers the urgency to buy because there's the feeling, well, it will always be there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a point where comic sales were going down, trades were becoming very ubiquitous, and it was, again, looking like there was a strong chance that at some point we'd hit that tipping point and trades would be kind of taking over as the dominant revenue stream, provided the publishers could, again, figure out, like you were talking about, how can they afford to generate all that content without the comic almost as a loss leader and go straight to that trade? But if you also look back in history, and I forget exactly when this was, it might have been 15 years ago, a little more, a little less. Diamond at one point said, if you don't do, I think it was like $2,500 worth of sales, it's not worth it for them to carry your comic.
Yeah.
This was around the time Claypool went from having 3 titles in print to going digital only to, I don't remember the last time I've really seen evidence they're still in business. And they may still be, I don't know. You know, and at that point, a lot of publishers were starting to go straight to trade. And some of them have continued to do that. Others reverted back to doing issues and then collecting to trade. I think the serial nature of comics is so baked into it, the format, the medium, the industry, that doing that cutover from what at the time was monthly comics, what's now, you know, biweekly comics, to, you know, a trade every 3, 6, 9 months, a year, whatever, it's a very different dynamic, and I think it's going to be a hard change to make.
Mm-hmm.
But as the comic price is $3.99 is ubiquitous now, I really can't imagine it going up again and comics surviving in the format they're in now.
Yeah. It's just going to be interesting, I think. I think that certain business models are going to have to be, I think you're going to have more stark difference between winners and losers, right? So if you cannot amortize that cost over single issues and abort, if you realize it's not working and you pay someone or you use your own money to make a 6-issue OGN, you know, effectively the page count of a 6-issue OGN, and you put it out and it's a complete dud, that is a big hit. You know what I mean? In terms of, cause you're not testing the market. You're also, it's like a big bet. And if, especially in the creator-owned world, you know, the people like Kirkman and Hickman can afford to have a few duds because they've had a wildly successful series and they have a lot of money in the bank to bankroll those. You know, like certain writers will literally pay the artist for the first 6 months without an issue being out, pay them their what they're agreed to, and they won't take a dime from the money back just so they can get 6 issues in the can. You know what I mean? But if you're just starting out, so like, the next people, like, you know, Donny Cates is considered one of the up and coming writers, you know, at Image, and he's doing a lot of stuff at Marvel. Is he gonna, it almost seems to me like the future is gonna be really the Kirkman Manifesto. You have to earn money at Marvel and DC, really build up your name, and then when you go to Image or go to creator owned, you have enough of an audience to actually make it financially viable. You know what I mean? It almost like force the issue. And you may have to keep your big two work just to finance yourself so you can get, until you can get, just like Hickman or Kirkman, if you have 3 or 4 books that are successful, it becomes this virtuous circle. And then you can kind of branch out and do projects that may be completely niche, but you really want to do, but you know, we'll only sell a couple thousand copies, but you wanted to do it anyways. And because you had something like The Walking Dead, who cares if it makes money? You have truckloads of money from The Walking Dead and you can do your passion projects. You know what I mean?
Well, is that a bad thing? Because I think there's a certain aspect of a creator should get their work out there, be it as a writer or an artist, go through, build up a body of work, get some experience before kind of, you know, headlining their own show, if you will. Otherwise, it's almost I don't say a vanity press thing, because that's not fair either. I think there's some people who go straight to creator-owned, and it's the right move for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's also a lot to be said for learn on, almost on somebody else's dime, if you will, and then kind of branch out on your own.
Well, I think the point I want to make is that if you see the funneling from both sides of that, that means that there are going to be a few winners and a lot of losers. There's going to be a graveyard of creators who put out a few brand new books at Image or their first time publishing, and it's going to be very difficult to make it. And I think that their Image is going to have a lot less success from people that are just starting out, and it's going to be people that really have a long-term career. You know what I mean? Like, it's going to be very tough, because I think unless you build, you have that solid base, or maybe you don't even, you have a day job that you work, and it's easier, obviously, if you're a writer versus the artist, right? If you're a writer and you have a 40-hour week job, and then you just on the weekends write comics for someone to draw, and you shoestring it along enough until you have enough financial success, it's just, I just think that it's going to create a situation where the winners will do very well, and there will be a lot of losers, like in the sense of I can't put any more books out because it's not affordable.
Well, I think if you look back at the history of Image in particular, you'll see a lot of books that started and never really got past, in some cases, a first issue because the creators didn't make any money on that and they couldn't continue to bankroll it.
Yeah. Well, and you see, and so one of the things I was worried about along those lines, if you extend that thinking out, you get to the point where if only the super successful, the top 5 to 10, because you kind of see that in modern entertainment in all forms. The most success, you know, the record companies put out the most successful. Look how movies are made today. Many directors say that it's very hard to get a middle budget film made because the only money you can get is for something that's like very, you know, like a horror movie for $5 million or less, or a big budget Marvel movie for $200 million. There's nothing in between because no one's willing to take a risk because the return on investment is very shaky there. So it's almost like, are we going to get a homogenous product on the top end, like, you know, just superhero movies? And, you know, like that version of that in comics, and or you're going to just have underground indie stuff, and the middle ground will be kind of really hard to find. But also what an answer to that is, when people like Kirkman have been so successful, he starts the Skybound imprint, and he takes chances on ideas from newcomers that he likes, and he basically takes a little percentage, you know, he takes, you know, interest in that property, but he pays them page rates, right, to get them off the ground. And if it's super successful, he owns a part of that, which, you know, he can see benefit down the road. But the creator at least got some initial capital off the ground, and it almost becomes like Kirkman or those people that start those imprints working capital for the new generation.
Which is ironic, given that Image started out as a attempt to get away, not even an attempt, a successful move to get away from work for hire. But then how almost every one of those guys heading a studio was then the one hiring the people to do work for hire.
Yeah. And who knows what those contracts are? I mean, it may be as innocuous as, you know, I'm going to pay you a page rate for the first 6 issues. And so then I have I own 10% of whatever this property makes over the, you know, whatever in the media time, whatever.
Absolutely. I think some of these people are also doing what you're suggesting of the, I'm going to help you mitigate your risk. It's still your property. You still have creator ownership. I'm just getting an interest percentage.
Yeah, exactly.
But then you look at, again, every one of these head guys of a studio at Image and how they've taken one of their properties and hired other people to go do it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kirkman hiring somebody else to go do, I forget if it was Brit or some of the other kind of offshoot properties from like Invincible and stuff like that. It's not a bad move. If you've got more interest in your properties than you can fulfill, hire people to help you. It's good business. It's just ironic given the way Image started.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, and it's just will be interesting to see if that's, you know, there are going to be outlets that, you know, basically kind of like patronage systems where, like, you know, the people that have made it in the industry, you know, along the lines of, you know, like Todd McFarlane obviously made it with Spawn and the toys and all that. And, you know, and Kirkman and the guys that run Shadowline, and, you know, they, you know, especially at like the Shadowline and those ones, they actually, their business model is, you know, we will give you a page rate, but we own part of the property. And they're kind of trying to, you know, further, you know, incubate ideas. You know, and I almost wonder if that'll become much more common at the Image model, because it'll just be so hard to break out completely on your own. Now, I still think that the Marvel and DC build up your audience and then, you know, start releasing creator owned stuff will be successful. I just see it in the sales of the Image singles now. It's just really hard to keep those books going, you know, for more. Look how many of those by issue 10, they're so low.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, the whole comic market is such that it favors the already successful.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get up that curve somehow, you can become like a Brian K. Vaughan. I mean, would we have Panel Syndicate if Brian K. Vaughan and Marcos Martin weren't already successful?
Yeah, that's true.
They couldn't afford to be doing things like The Private Eye and the other stuff they've done to great success.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if they were just newcomers to the industry saying, we've got this great idea, I'll tell you what, let's go spend, you know, however long it took them to go create that material without getting paid. Oh, and let's go start up this website and, you know, have people just pay whatever they feel it's worth. I mean, that's an insane, financial risk. Mm-hmm. But if you've got the audience built in, like you said, you've built it up over at Marvel and DC. So you've got that track record, you've got that name recognition, and you can drive them to your website versus a who the hell are you again?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. The other thing you had mentioned a few minutes ago was kind of the aborting to trade concept.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a couple of things doing that of late. Not tons, but enough to be annoying if you bought the issues and then you've got to rebuy that part of the trade and stuff.
Well, I definitely remember hearing your last, I think it was last week's or the week before's comics, weekly comics podcast. And you were speaking about, that with, the new co-host and about having to rebuy things and how it was super annoying. And I totally got that, but there was a part of me that said, oh, John, I never have to worry about this. I just purchased the trade.
It's one of the many things I think driving people to trade.
Yeah.
Cal Exit is the one I'm tracking now, and I'm expecting issues 4 and 5 to get canceled. Because they've solicited the trade of collecting number 1 through 3 and previously unreleased material. Now, I'm thinking if you do that in a previews, you ought to have following along in that month's cancellation list those two issues.
Uh-huh.
But they didn't. You know, it's the nature of the industry, I guess. It's a little annoying. But what you gonna do? Probably switch to trade, I think, is a lot of people's answer, and I can't fault them for that.
Yeah, it will be interesting, I think, to see, you know, Astro City is probably one of my all time favorite comics. So I will be interested to see the change in their publishing format, because one of the things that I noticed is for a while there for this new the volume that they just basically are finishing up is, you know, Brent Anderson was the primary artist for a very long time. And then, you know, for the especially for the previous volumes, you know, he did the art, Busick wrote, and then Alex Ross did covers, and that was it. And they just, if it was late, they would just wait until they were finished and put it out. And it got to a point where they actually did bring in different artists. You know, that was a big change just to kind of keep the book a little bit more consistent. And now that they're going to the OGN, I wonder if the decreased scheduling deadline will. If they're going to be able to stick to putting out like one OGN a year or two a year, or if this not having to hit monthly deadlines or, you know, once every 6 weeks, if that's going to have the book be slipping and, you know, not shipping on time. And then just like everything we talk about, you know, Brian Hibbs mentions all the time, the weekly habit in a lot of these series, because there's so many books being published, if the person doesn't see it semi-regularly on the shelf, it doesn't exist to them anymore and they fall off it. And that's what so much of the turnover is, I think. And it'll be interesting to see. I mean, at this point, with how many years Astro City has been, there is obviously a hardcore fan base. Like, I'll search out any if they would do like omnibuses of Astro City, I would buy like 2 or 3 and hand them out. But you know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah,
there's diehard fans. But it'll be interesting to see if they can't keep a normal cadence, if they're going to lose it, because they obviously have enough sales data because they put out collected editions of, you know, the last, you know, 15 years that they've been doing this. So I'm assuming they've looked at this and said, this is a more profitable way, or this is easier for us, or this is the only way we can do it now. But it'll be interesting to see if they can't keep publishing regularly, if they're going to fall prey to that out of sight, out of mind.
I'm also wondering if some of it is that Kirkman's got longer stories that just don't break as easily into issues.
You mean Busick?
But yes. Busick, I'm sorry. You're right. Kurt Busick.
Yeah.
Because I think he may feel a little bad about Brent Anderson not having been like the artist on Astro City for the whole run, and having to get a couple of those guest artists. Now, those guest artists have done a terrific job, and in a couple of cases were really well picked for the story.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how much of that is to ease some deadline pressure or to just work better with where they want to go with the property.
Yeah. So I will be eagerly following to see how that does in sales, just in terms of it. Are they going this route because it'll be easier on the creators, or is it the only financial viable way they see the future, or they think it will enhance the storytelling? Because like you said, you know, a 90 page to 100 page chunk is what they feel like a good, you know, or maybe 160, I don't know, is what a good, you know, Astro City story should be now. I don't know. Cause you know, Kirk Busick has done a really good job at telling single issue stories, 2 issue stories, 3 issue stories, or the, you know, a lot of people don't like the Dark Age, and that was 2, 4, or I think it was 2 8 issue chunks.
I think it was 3-4 issue ones maybe, but
yeah. But it was like a lot over, you know, when you put it together, it was a long arc.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably one of the less liked on average of the series. But, you know, I think he has such range in terms of telling stories over, you know, I think he's very good at, if he knows he has two issues, he can do it in two. If he knows he wants to do a done in one, you know, he's one of the better writers for that. So it'll be interesting. I'll be eager to see how those sell and if they can put them out maybe at least two a year, or if they get only one a year, that's going to be, you know, you're going to have to put out at least one a year, or else in a year in the comics business without a release is like, I don't know how you recover from that.
Well, and that's the challenge, I think, on the industry, if it were to ever try to shift to trade, is the cadence is so different.
Uh-huh.
Because it's going to be at least every 3 months, more like every six, or, you know, maybe you get one or two a year, whatever. That's a very different buying pattern and hard to get the people into the store every week versus the speed with which stuff is coming out now.
Mm-hmm.
And it works in both directions in terms of, you know, with the amount of stuff I buy, I've never successfully tracked. If I had gotten that same content in trade, how much of a feast or famine would that have been from week to week?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it kind of averages out or whatever with the individual comics and such.
Yeah. Well, and it would actually be interesting from your perspective is in these periods when you get behind, and are these becoming more like 3 months of the year you're behind, or 4 months, you know, like how, if, have you ever tracked like how long of the total year you're behind? Because if at a certain point it's like half the year you're behind, then it's almost like you have a trade worth of a series sitting, and that's what you're reading at a time. Aren't you almost doing it anyways?
Well, it tends that I get behind around Comic-Con. Mm-hmm. And around kind of the beginning of the year, because that's when I tend to have like the numbers doubling up and some other stuff going on.
And just family stuff going on. And
yeah. But it's not so predictable or whatever that it would make sense necessarily, to, for me at least, to cut over to trade. But some of that also goes down to whenever they do a new initiative over at Marvel or DC and relaunch a number of titles, that kind of synchronizes the trade releases almost.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, I like getting the story in full in one sitting, but there's something that it's less intimidating to read a comic, even if there's six in a row, than let me go pick up that trade.
Yeah, that's true. And I think it's also tough because you're the way you interact with the, you know, the hobby, you do a podcast that in it, and because you like talking about current comics, it would be a major shift for you to switch. You know what I mean? It would just, you'd have to reorient things. You'd have to either do like 12 back issue spotlights in a row for 12 weeks until this, you know, everything caught up, or it would just be, it would be very difficult, I think.
Well, and at some point the podcast may go through that transition, particularly if DC were to ever do an equivalent to the Marvel Digital Comics Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
But it would come down to, do I want to switch away from the physical where I own it and I have a copy to almost the rental model with those subscription services?
Yeah. You know, I will say, you know, it's interesting, and, you know, every person is different. You know, when I was in my teens and early 20s, before Netflix really took, you know, I had a lot of CDs and a lot of movies. But as soon as things like Spotify and Netflix became pretty robust in terms of the content they offered, and I'm a huge fan of Marvel Unlimited. That's the only way. I don't purchase Marvel comics or trades except for maybe like the top 5%. Like my favorite storyline for each of like a character, like my favorite, Wolverine story is Old Man Logan. So I have the hardcover of that, you know, so I will purchase, but I'll purchase like the top end version of whatever, like my favorite arcs for one person or one character, or my favorite story for a team. I'll purchase the high end version of that. But otherwise, so like 95% of everything I read in Marvel is in the app, and it's only about 5% that I then buy subsequently, just because I like it and I want to share it with people, or I just like the idea of being able to pull it off the shelf and look at it. But, you know, with Netflix and Spotify, I don't purchase media anymore. You know what I mean? So
I think that's a little bit of the age difference between us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still an old fogey or whatever, and I do purchase the Blu-rays and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
There's something about, again, having a copy and not it being at the whims of, well, is it still on Netflix or something?
Well, and also, like, every once in a while, the internet goes down and it's a Friday night and you want to watch a movie and your internet is down. Guess what? You're reading a book, or you're just sitting there, you know, or you have to do something else. So there are downsides to everything. It is interesting, though. But I will say, if you ever have to move your house or move, you will become much, you will take at least two or three steps towards my direction no matter what, because
it... No, I'll take two or three steps towards a really serious back injury.
Yeah, that too, but yeah, after about the fourth or fifth day of moving all that, you'll be like, maybe I should reevaluate this.
At some point I will move, and at some point I already know that the amount of stuff I have is going to be an issue with that. But yeah. So with the top 300 trades this month, it totaled to just below 250,000 units. So 249,270 units for the top 300. That is the second lowest the total has been since Diamond had reported the top 300 or more trades. Last month was the lowest.
Hmm.
So not in the best of times for the direct market on either the comics or the trade side.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at the top couple of publishers within the top 300, DC had the largest amount with 26.86% of the total units, followed by Image with 23.36%, and then Marvel with 22.5% of the total units for the top 300. That is right there, 72.72% of the total units for the top 300. If we add in Dark Horse with its 5.42%, skipping over one for a sec, I'll come back to in a minute, but then IDW with its 2.56%, Boom with its 2.4%, and Dynamite with its 2.25%, that gets us to 85.35% of the total units for the top 300 based on what is, according to previews, premier publishers. And I say according to previews because technically none of the stuff from Boom and Dynamite that I've just counted is from a previews where they were a premier publisher, but that's splitting hairs, I think. And the one we jumped over was Viz, which is, again, manga type stuff with its 3.81%. And at that point, we've accounted for over 89% of the units for the top 300. And we've got, another 18 publishers on the list? So it's one of those where it's a very lopsided kind of field. And again, a slow month for trades compared to how it usually does.
Yeah, it is interesting kind of to see these trends. I mean, you've been talking on the single issue side how there's been, drastic downturn in sales for certain publishers. You know, like Dark Horse is going through a rough patch. You know, obviously Marvel's been having some issues, although the new editor-in-chief, I think, is kind of, I've just been reading some things online how the creators are kind of re-energized, and, some of the they just had the retailer summit, and a lot of the retailers are positive feelings about going forward. You know, the guys at Cowabunga put out a podcast about that, and they said they think that he's hopefully going to turn that around. So we'll see.
I hope so, because I think the industry needs that.
Mm-hmm.
I think they need both Marvel and DC at the top of their game, competing neck and neck and pushing each other creatively, and not just kind of poking at each other, trying to think what's the right way to phrase. I mean, because like the new age of DC heroes essentially being, repaints of Marvel characters, I don't think that's doing either company any good.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that, we've got Marvel, DC, Image. Again, we've got roughly a four-way split between Marvel, DC, Image, and everybody else. Mm-hmm. And that's better than how we tend to have a three-way split of Marvel, DC, and everybody else on the comic side, but not a whole lot better.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see a lot of these other publishers competing a little bit more successfully in the top 300, because I think they've got the same level of talent and properties. It's just the market, again, favors the already successful. The odds of us ever seeing a publisher routinely doing as well or better than Marvel and DC on both the comics and the trade side is really low.
Well, yeah, I think it would take, the direct market is so distinct. I think it would take Marvel making a decision that they were just going to do digital, and that they, they just wanted the IP. They didn't want to spend the money doing all the creation. They were just going to use the characters that they had created so far. And I think that would be, obviously, that would most likely crash the direct market. So I don't foresee that happening anytime soon, but it'd be something like that where Marvel decided to disengage from the direct market.
Well, and it's interesting you cite exclusively Marvel for that.
Well, you know how that in my perception, so I will say it's my opinion, DC cares more about the direct marketing than Marvel. Marvel is as corporate a company and as a for-profit a company as there exists in the direct market. Yeah, that's just my opinion.
I agree with you completely. I was not challenging that. I just thought it was interesting that you had excluded DC from that, because let's face it, Marvel has already in the past done a move that nearly toppled the direct market when they went self-distributed.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, you see it in their pricing structure. I mean, you look at the top price for one of their items this month was $500. Now, I get that that's a box of 10 hardcovers. I get it. But, you know, just in general, they always price their stuff higher than their competition, and their pricing policies all across their line. And you see all these rumors and stories about how penny pinching they are up and down the line. And I just think that, and you know what, as a for-profit business in the American capitalist system, a lot of businesses operate that. I'm not saying that Marvel's the only one to do that. I'm just saying there are a few people at DC that are keeping DC from being like that. So if there were to be leadership changes, there could be some definite movement towards the way Marvel does things at DC. You know, I can't remember who's in charge at DC right now, but if he retired or something happened, you know, that may change.
Dan Didio and Jim Lee are the ones that I think are doing a lot to keep the I don't say the direct market intact, but if history had played out differently and it was DC who had started with a Digital Comics Unlimited kind of a program and not Marvel, and had the level of success or viability of it that Marvel has had, and we were in the boat of DC has it, Marvel doesn't, Marvel would have jumped on it by now. And I think that would have had a serious ramification on comic book sales and in turn trade sales and in turn the entire direct market. And I don't know that we would be having the information or the direct market around to be having these discussions. Because, again, to your point, Marvel is more short-term thinking and more capitalist, whereas I think some of what DC has done historically has been very much in a longer-term financial business plan, even if they don't always have the best long-term creative plans, and some of it is out of, a genuine love that certain of their higher-ups have had of the comic industry. I mean, Dan Didio has been very vocal over the years about supporting what he calls the Wednesday Warriors, and that's kind of what he sees as the backbone of the direct market. And Paul Levitz, before him, was a hardcore, long-term comic book fan, having worked at DC for decades. And I think some of the decisions he made as the publisher of DC, that Paul Levitz made, were out of as much a genuine love of comics as well as, is it just good business or not? The decision to, with the Spirit Archives and stuff, when they signed that deal, I think that was something that was a bit of a passion project or whatever for Levitz. And the fact they were able to transition the trade dress from Dark Horse to DC smoothly, and it worked well for collectors and stuff like that. That's not a business decision. That's a creative decision, keeping in mind the interest of the fans and trying to keep the goodwill. Whereas, I mean, look at how many times, Marvel's gone in opposite directions. I mean, heck, they've changed the trade dress on the Masterworks a time or two, and said, hey, for another $5, you can get the old version if you still like it. So it's different mindsets at the two company.
Oh, absolutely.
If we jump over to the top trades list itself, we've got at the top of the list, we've got Walking Dead Volume 29 with 14,890 units. Technically, this is reorder activity because some stuff, snuck in on the list last time around. So we kind of knew this was going to top the list. The second place item of Green Lantern Earth 1 Volume 1 hardcover at 9,040 units is also fairly impressive. I think I'd have to go look back at how some of the other Earth 1 stuff did when it initially launched. But from there, we get under the 3,500 units. So there's a sizable gap between, ranks 2 and 3.
Yeah, this actually brings up an interesting point to talk about. So, we just talked a little bit earlier about how some of the pressures and the current environment in the direct market are forcing either publishers or creators to consider the OGN model. And it's interesting to look at DC with their Earth One model over the last couple of years and how they've had great successes like the Batman and Superman, and also ones like the Wonder Woman, where the creators couldn't quite get it out on time. And then the follow up, which was supposed to be 6 to 8 months, you know, it still isn't out. I think it's scheduled to come out soon, you know, the Wonder Woman one. But it's almost, you know, we talk about that publishing cadence and the momentum from a great sales from the Superman one and the Batman one. I know they made two or three, but I don't remember any more being solicited. So does that mean they just are done, or were they, you know what I mean? So like this is kind of an example of the other people are looking at this as a way forward, but was it as successful as DC hoped?
Well, yeah, when you were saying they've had great success with the Earth One stuff, I was going to question, I mean, kind of have they really? And I'm not saying they haven't. Mm-hmm. I'm honestly not so sure.
And another thing to consider is maybe the success they had, it's just like anything else. When you put Batman in it, it sells like gangbusters. I mean, how many friggin' series of Batman are going on right now? And they, you know, it's easy to find a writer and an artist to pair, you know, dream combinations, because there's seemingly infinite amount of demand for Batman stories. And maybe that's why Batman and Superman are easy sells in the OGM market. Now, this is doing, you know, realistically solid starting off sales. Gabriel Hardman is a good, you know, relatively well-known creator who's worked at both of the big two and has some image work and other stuff. And so, you know, maybe if we see in a few months that there's solid reorder activity of this, we could say that's good. But, you know, hasn't this been in the works for a couple of years? That's another thing, right? So it's just the time that it takes, and is that enough payoff for it?
Well, and I think it's a prime example of, are they getting the story momentum or the, again, that cadence or whatever to really make this kind of work? Because it can be, you know, a significant amount of time between one volume and the next coming out. And as a reader, I find that very frustrating.
Yeah. And, you know, we talk all the time about, you know, the image model with a 2 month break versus at the big two, sometimes they have to have subs in for art, subs in for, especially when they're, you know, twice a month publishing. So it's almost if they really wanted to commit to this Earth One and they put an OGN out every 6 months, but can you keep the same creative team? And if not, then do you lose some of the sales because the difference in art and the difference in storytelling is so jagged between one and the other? And there's all these problems we deal with that we've dealt with on the single issue side that can kind of migrate over here too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Just doing some quick number crunching and such. The volume one of the Batman Earth One hardcover has done somewhere around 55,593 units. Over time, this is total aggregate. Uh-huh. Superman Earth One, hardcover volume one, 51,137. Titans, Earth One volume one hardcover, 9,674 units. And Wonder Woman Earth One hardcover volume one, 20,400.
Quick question for you, and I don't know if this would take some time, so it may not be good, podcasting. How long till the second volumes of at least the Superman and the Batman? I'm not even sure. I know the Wonder Woman second volume isn't out, and I think the Teen Titans is, but how many months between volume one and two of the Batman and the Superman, and then what are the aggregate sales for the second volumes? Because I would just be interesting to see if it's more than 12 months and then you see much less sales. Obviously, they've been out a year less, so there's some aggregate there, but just be interesting to see if they lost some of that sales momentum. And just like you said, 50,000 units for those. I will say that there is quite a representation of those Earth One hardcovers at places like Barnes & Noble. Barnes & Noble, in a lot of ways, when those were coming out and those were doing well sales-wise in direct market, they had very prominent placement in the graphic novel section at Barnes & Noble. So there might have been quite a bit of sales there too. It'd just be interesting about the follow-up.
So I just did a quick search in my database for the first ship date for the hardcovers of the Earth One stuff. Mm-hmm. Batman Volume 1 was July 2012. Mm-hmm. Volume 2 was May 2015.
Oh, that's a long time between.
That to me kills momentum.
Yeah.
Superman Earth One Volume 1 of the hardcover, end of October 2010. Volume 2, end of October 2012. Volume 3, February 2015.
Yeah, see, and I didn't even know that they had done a Volume 3. I read Volume 1 of both the Batman and the Superman and enjoyed them. I read Volume 2 of the Batman and enjoyed that. I'm not sure I remember reading the Volume 2 of the Superman, and I didn't even know that they had published Volume 3. So see how it... And if I'm a guy that pays attention and I'm on the internet, and I actually keep a very curated list of things I want to read in my Amazon wish list, and you know, things coming out, because the nice thing about Amazon is the publishers have to tell Amazon like 6 to 8 months before it comes out to get like a preview page and pre-order. So I see stuff that's not even coming out till, you know, July of next year. I there's pages for it that I can save to my queue. So yeah, I didn't even know that they published a third volume of that.
So. Let's consider that end of October 2010 is the launch of the Earth One initiative. Mm-hmm. Okay? Nothing came out in 2011. Halfway through 2012, we get that Batman Earth One Volume 1. Mm-hmm. And then about 3 months later, we get that Volume 2 of the Superman. Nothing in 2013. The only thing in 2014 was middle of November with the Teen Titans Earth One hardcover Volume 1. Then about 3 months later, we get the third volume of the Superman. About 3 months later, we get the second volume of Batman. Then nearly a year later, in April 2016, we get the first volume of Wonder Woman. About 4 months later, the second volume of Teen Titans. And nothing in 2017. And here we are in March of 2018 getting this Green Lantern Earth 1. So even if you consider all of Earth 1... as one property, and since they don't really interconnect at all, as far as I know, I'm going to say, I don't know that that's a good, fair statement to make. But even if you did, over the course of, you know, 8 years, 9 years or whatever, it's a horrible cadence.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe I can't be as optimistic about that. It's just interesting because there's, you know, clearly they've tried this with their Earth One series, and aren't they going to be doing... their announcements with some of their, you know, kid focused lines and things like that, they're going to be doing a lot of this. So they're going to be refocusing on making sure it comes out more consistent, but you know, let's just hope that they can do that. Cause I think when you talk about single issue sales, momentum and publishing every week is important. And then it may be doubly that for, you know, OGNs, if you don't keep a consistent output, almost like Bande Dessinée in Europe, you know what I mean? Like the 56 page, but they come out every 3 to 4 months. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So like that almost looks like maybe they need to look at the European model of, yeah, there is time between, but they're chunkier, you know, 50 to 60 to 70 pages. And yeah, they cost more, you know, it'll be interesting to see which direction they head.
But you look at something like the DC Superhero Girls, and those trades seem to be coming out roughly every 6 months-ish.
Uh-huh.
So I think they've got a better cadence there.
Yeah.
But they've also got, either a web series or TV series kind of helping back that up, plus the toys, et cetera. Whereas between installments of the Earth One hardcovers, sure, maybe they reprint a trade or something, but there's nothing to keep that universe alive.
Yeah. Well, and I think also you just went into that problem where maybe the Earth One was initiated as these are creator focused. So you have a writer and an artist and they're doing this series. And then you run into that problem of them not being able to keep that cadence. So maybe like on the Supergirl series, you know, those ones, they have, you know, multiple artists or more than one, you know, set of creators. So almost like just in the single issues, you have other people, and you know, with the style of the comics for young kids, maybe it's not as noticeable when there's a change in art or a change in creator. Whereas obviously, like, you know, Green Lantern Earth One, written and drawn by Gabriel Hardman, is a very distinct style. He likes his stuff colored a certain way. It's very, you can tell when Gabriel Hardman is drawing a comic book. And if all of a sudden you had someone complete, you know, like Greg Land drawing it, you'd be like, what the, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think, though, that's part of why if I were spinning up a publishing company, and I was talking about this on the teleconference and stuff. I mean, I'm of the mindset that just like hand drawing animation for an animated movie or TV show isn't viable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's not viable for comics. I'm saying I wouldn't do it. I would do computer generated art, and gotcha. I would want it to look hand drawn. Okay. But the difference is I think you could then have a bunch of computer artists that are through the technology producing the same style, the look, the feel, that you've got a consistency there. And I think you could also bake in a few other things that are what drive writers and such away from comics, which is, you know, there's not really a huge payday there. But if you're already generating the art that way, you're really a hop, skip, and a jump from being able to do an animated feature based on it, at which point it's going to be it'll be exactly what you had already written for the comic. So kind of by signing the writer for the comic, he's already signed his movie deal almost.
Yeah.
Whether it's a theatrical movie or not, it's another question. But I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, trying to find more cost-effective ways to produce this material and get it to where it can be out on a timelier basis and not have those radical shifts in art style between either volumes of a series of hardcovers or even chapters of a story that gets collected into a trade because it bounced from title to title to title on the comic side. You know, it's, if people like a certain art style and that's one of the things that draws them to a book and three issues later you shift to something radically different, you're going to lose some readers.
Absolutely. I mean, that's kind of a, you know, one of the positives of the Image model is you have these creators, you have these, you know, universes that they are creating that you don't necessarily see have to be rebooted and things like that. You know, so there's positives and negatives with anything in life. And it's just, it's all trying to balance it. And like you said, comics is such a, or I should say the direct market is such a niche market that, you know, there's a lot of limitations, unfortunately, that get put on it.
Yeah, but I think the direct market is a more educated market about comics. So when they pick up a trade that has, or a hardcover that's got a bunch of different artists who've done chapters of the story, they kind of know that going in. They don't really think anything about it. Whereas I think that same sort of a story in that same trade, if somebody in the mass market looks at it, they're going to flip. They're going to say either this art's great, this art sucks, whatever. And then 30 pages later, they're going to be looking at it and thinking the exact opposite. And they're going to be like, what's going on here? This is amateur hour.
Yeah.
It would be as if you switched actors in a primetime TV show at every commercial break.
Yeah, that's a very good good point. It's a very good point.
So it's a bizarre industry and medium given the way it's evolved over the decades. And there's nothing right or wrong about it, but all these things have different, you know, sales ramifications, and some things work better for some readers than others.
Well, and there is so much variety, you know, it's and almost to our detriment that apparently it just, some of the average sales numbers for these, it just seems like it's not sustainable. And in a lot of series, it isn't. And, you know, that's why a lot of the publishers in the back struggle, because it's just such a thin line between continuing to put out product and then have revenue coming in to back that, you know.
Well, speaking of that, the median, the midpoint of the top 300 was 524 units. Half did that much or better, half did that much or worse.
Yeah. Now, you know, one thing that we have to remind people when they think about that, because they think like, if that was true, and how could any publisher, you know, make a living? A lot of the trade list is reorder activity, whereas on the single issue side, that's much less common. You know, there's quite a bit of reorder activity on the trade side. So where, you know, if the median is 500 copies and some of those ones below it, they're just adding on to maybe an initial of 2,000, 3,000. So, you know, it is sustainable.
Well, and that's what I was talking about earlier about the difference between where's the growth and where's the profit.
Yeah.
Because these things that are on this list, aside from stuff like the Earth One that's original, the content has already been paid for, hopefully. Maybe not exclusively, maybe it has, maybe it hasn't. In certain cases, it absolutely has.
Yeah.
But then it's one of those things that once they've gotten that collection out there and keep it in print, which is its own challenge, it's something that is just money coming in at that point. Now, it's obviously got to make enough to have paid for its printing, et cetera, for the print run. But some of the stuff is almost, I don't want to say found money, but like at rank 87, we've got the Hawk and Dove, the Silver Age trade paperback. Silver Age material. They've long since paid for its content. Maybe they had to pay to clean it up to get it to where it's ready to go into a trade. Don't know, but nominal cost. 875 units. This is something that, it's not lighting the world on fire, but Hawk and Dove, or a Hawk and Dove, maybe not, well, certainly not this version of Dove, but I think this version of Hawk, are going to be featured in the Titans series that's going to be on the streaming DC thing whenever it comes to be. So that may get a lot more interest into the Hawk and Dove property. May not, don't know. But at which point, they've already prepped the work, they've got it out there, they can see the benefit of it. A good example of that sort of a thing might be at rank 51 with the New Mutants Demon Bear trade paperback, which did 1,156 units. This is collecting the Bill Sienkiewicz run of New Mutants from 18 to 20, along with an issue of X-Force 99 from the 1991 run, and then 7 to 10 from the X-Force's 2008 run. So it's got some other creators involved in that, because I'm pretty sure Claremont and Sienkiewicz didn't do those other ones. But this is something that may appeal to people who are fans of Legion, the character, who's also got the FX show that's currently in its second season, that originated in that Demon Bear storyline back in New Mutants 18 to 20.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes having those TV movies can generate some new interest, even if it's just within the direct market of, oh yeah, I haven't read that, I should go check that out. Now here's a convenient trade to go do it.
Absolutely. Gives them an opportunity to explore that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, while a lot of this is stuff that, you know, hey, you've hit six issues, collect it, pump it to trade, is just a knee-jerk reaction, there's a surprising amount of Marvel and DC material in particular, a number of other publishers, from the 70s, 80s, and 90s that has never been collected.
Ah.
So there's still more found money to be had, if you will. And again, that's not the best term, because for some of the stuff, they've got to go collect the original stuff that they put into print and get it ready for its current digital formatting, both to go to digital, but also to go to a digital pre-press kind of a process.
Absolutely.
But sooner or later, we will get, you know, the complete runs of stuff that we've never seen. All-Star Squadron, Infinity Inc., some of the JSA stuff, many of, the era of The Flash and Firestorm that's getting milked for the CW shows, a lot of that they could get into print.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope they do. It's classic stuff that I read as it was coming out off the spinner rack and such, but current fans of the CW shows probably have no idea where some of these characters originated.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting because, like, I think some generations, you know, I kind of, in a lot of ways, each generation of comic reader comes in and they get introduced to a set of characters, and that's kind of like their introduction to comics and their kind of like ground floor. And then some people take the time and effort to explore where the original characters came from, or like the past of the teams and things like that. And some people just move forward and say, this is, you know, just like people, you know, your age and my age say, oh, my X-Men are the original ones, or, you know, people a little bit older said, oh, the Kirby originals, the Fantastic Four original, you know what I mean? So it's just interesting how everyone has their era of that was, you know. So many times on the internet, you hear people say, oh, that's, you know, they ruined the character for me. You know, that's not my Captain America. That's not my Fantastic Four. I can't believe, they changed Batman's outfit, you know. And so much of it is because when they first came to the character, it's almost like a freeze frame of their childhood and that nostalgia. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. It's interesting because sometimes, I mean, Drew and I had this conversation often on the Weekly Comic Spotlight when he was the co-host, that he would be like, I love this new character they introduced of this, that, and the other. I'm like, well, actually, it's not a new character. It's either a new version or they brought this character back or whatever. But it was introduced in a way that there was no way in the issue to realize it was bringing somebody back and it wasn't a new character or something.
Mm-hmm.
So from his point of view, it truly was a new one, and I get that, I acknowledge that, and I don't disagree with that. But if you've got that longer history of reading, you realize it's a riff on this that they've already done, or it's literally they just brought this person out from limbo that they haven't used for 20 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how kind of everything that's old is new again, and how, you know, one of the other things we were talking about on the teleconference was, they're bringing back the Fantastic Four, and there was the discussion of, well, do they need to kind of put those characters on the shelf for a bit so they can bring them back and revitalize them or something? And my mindset is, you've always got to, you know, at least once a decade, the character's got to be enough different than it was a decade ago that it's relatable to the modern audience. Because if you hadn't done that with Spider-Man, we'd still be seeing a Peter Parker with the glasses hunched over, you know, the microscope or whatever, because that's science.
Mm-hmm.
You know, versus, you know, a modern take, if you were to reboot Spider-Man, he would be a Twitter or YouTube star, much like we've seen in Sideways, you know? but these should be incremental changes, not radical revolutions of the character every decade. But you also shouldn't need to take the character and toss him in the equivalent of the Disney vault for a couple of years, like the Marvel's done with Thor, Fantastic Four, Wolverine, and a couple other characters, Steve Rogers even, to bring them back and make them fresh and new. If you're doing that, there's something wrong with the way you're telling your stories. And there are going to be certain characters that fall in and out of favor, and that makes sense. So I'm not saying every character should always be published, but there's an aspect of timelessness to some of these characters that I think is getting either overlooked, ignored, or misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
It's surprising to me how often they revolume a title and how infrequently they kind of make the subtle retoolings of the character they need to keep it relevant to the modern audience. So it's also fun to see, you know, again, when they pull back stuff from the Silver Age, the Golden Age, and collect it and put it out there as a trade or a hardcover, how some of it resonates more with the audience than others.
Oh, yeah. No, and you can, you know, different, you know, it's kind of like one of those things. It's like there are a certain subset of people that are interested in exploring, you know, that past, and like, you know, people that are interested in digital when they do make those print editions are like, oh, wow, I'm going to check this out. I've always wanted to, you know, I've heard so many good things about this run, but I've never, you know, been able to get access to it. Now they're publishing it and I'll check it out. And then, you know, it's interesting sometimes, like when people for the first time read Kirby comics or the first time and they're like, oh, wow, this is so different than today. But I can see why it was so exciting at the time, because there's so much, you know, dynamic. It's just so different.
I think some of that comes down to how well educated the audience is.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the John Carter movie came out, people were like, this is so derivative of stuff. Not realizing it was a 100-year-old property that everything they thought it was derivative of derived from it.
Yep.
So there's some of that.
Yeah.
And to me, some of that's on the presenter of the material to give the subtle or maybe not so subtle clues as to this predated this other stuff that you may be comparing it to.
Mm-hmm.
What else do we got on the list that looks interesting?
Well, one I wanted to highlight was that Quantity Rank 11, the Alien Dead Orbit, which is the, I think, 4-issue miniseries by James Stokoe, who I was introduced to his stuff with the Orc Stain at Image, and he does a lot of variant covers, and he has a very distinct style. And what I find interesting about this is, you know, 2000 isn't, you know, 2465 isn't too bad. You know, it's actually Dark Horse's biggest seller this month for the collected editions. But what I find interesting is because, you know, he does creator work, and then he does work like this, Work for Hire. And his previous stuff that I really liked was Godzilla Half Century War from IDW.
Mm-hmm.
And they put that out as little paperback, you know, a normal size paperback. And then like 6 months later, they put out like an oversized hardcover. And because I like his art, that's the way I got it. So I skipped this because I'm waiting for them to do the same, you know, to do the same thing. Now, obviously IDW and Dark Horse are different. You know, I'm assuming that Dark Horse will do that, but that's me deciding to wait for a different edition. And, you know, have the companies got themselves into an issue where they're, you know, everyone keeps waiting for the edition they want, right? Obviously, this is only 4 issues. It's not going to be an omnibus, but they may put an oversized hardcover. And I really like James Stokoe's art, and that's what I preferred in. But if this doesn't sell well enough, or the singles issues didn't sell well enough, will it get to a point where they can't justify it? And then will I remember to go back and buy this if that never comes out? You know what I mean? So there's all these things that are interesting about the business side versus the, I definitely want to own this and read this, but I want the oversized hardcover. But if I don't support it, you know, I didn't buy the singles, I didn't buy this. If enough people do that, then it's like the whole ecosystem is a disaster. You know what I mean?
This is why I get comics in individual issues. I'm too lazy to go through all that work. Just listening to that exhausted me.
Oh, I know it exhausted you, but here's my counter to that. I have hundreds of collected editions to read. So in the meantime, while I'm waiting for that, it's not like I'm just sitting here waiting for that to come out. Because I know a lot of listeners would be the same way and say, oh my gosh, you're putting way too much thought into it. But I really, you know, certain people have certain preferred avenues, and I love James Stokoe's art. So I want to see an oversized hardcover because I want to purchase that. I know I want to purchase it, and I will pay, you know, Dark Horse is actually pretty well priced. If it was published by Marvel, I would grudgingly give them my money, but I would still give it to them because I really like James Stokoe. I would be like cursing at them at the same time when I submitted my credit card. But you know that I always do that when I buy Marvel products that are overpriced. But I really want this in that format. But I understand from a store owner's perspective or from the publishing company's perspective, I have segregated myself into a market. And if this book doesn't have enough revenue to justify that, that should be worrisome to them, to a certain aspect of it. Because one aspect of Kirkman's model is you publish in every format possible as long as it, you know, you can make money on it. The singles, the six issue trades, the 12 issue hardbacks, the, you know, the omnibuses, and then the compendium. But not everything has that much legs. You know what I mean? Not everything can support that. So,
but that's a problem of the industry's own making.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like Kirkman has shown that that can work. And so a lot of people are going to that, but are they sacrificing on one end because they're trying to get to this other end? And you see some workarounds to it. You know, Kirkman did 6 issues, 12 issues, 24 issues, and then the 48 issues in the compendium. Some of the other ones like Hickman and what's the guy that does Deadly Class with Wes Craig? I forget. He also does Black Science, the writer, and also Saga does this. The hardcovers are 3 trades worth. So if you want that hardcover, you really have to hold out for quite a few months because that's 16 to 18 issues. That takes quite a while. So, you know, maybe there's enough incentive for the people to stay on the trades. And then if you're a really Uber buyer, you'll buy the hardcover too. You know what I mean? So you can see them trying different strategies to maximize their revenue from their fans.
Well, if we jump down to rank 318 and use that as an example, it's the Injustice Gods Among Us Year 1 Complete Collection. Mm-hmm. This came out digitally. Mm-hmm. So that was your first chance to buy it. Mm-hmm. 2 or 3 of those issues, I forget which it were compiled into a individual print issue, so that was your second chance to buy it. 6 of those individual issues were then compiled into a trade paperback. Mm-hmm. That was your third chance to buy it. I think they may have even done hardcovers prior to this complete collection, so that would have been your fourth chance to buy it. So by the time you get this complete collection, which would have been your fifth, and then a trade of it, which would have been your sixth, mm-hmm. you were definitely in the habit of not buying this material.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting you bring that one up because I do collect that series, but I only do it in the complete year 12 issue format that you just spoke about. I heard such great things from, you know, when you guys were mm-hmm. reviewing it, other reviewers, but I didn't want to spend the 99, you know, the 3 digital issues for an issue or whatever. So I didn't read that, but I knew that it was very good. And I did read the first hardcover trade that was released to the library. And I read that and I was like, ooh, this is really good. I'm going to wait till it comes out in a format, you know, where it's like, I like big chunks, and especially in something that's released like that. So I waited until they started soliciting the complete years. Now I have them in soft cover. I think they're eventually going to release them in hardcover too or whatever. But it's interesting, you know, it's like the segmentation of the market. And that's a perfect example. I waited quite a while, but I still bought it. And in fact, I've got the first two years on my shelf, and I just ordered in my last shipment from In-Stock Trades, the third year complete paperback.
Well, and again, wait for the copy that suits you. I completely agree with that from a reader point of view. If that is disadvantageous to the publisher, that's on them. They shouldn't have given us so many options.
Yeah, so Dark Horse published that oversized hardcover Alien Dead Orbit stat.
I mean, there have been a couple of things I've tried to get in those hardcovers in that, you know, later incarnation. Uh-huh. But they come out every couple of years. Uh-huh. And by the time I think some of the others came out, I just lost track of it.
Yeah.
Because again, not out every month, it's off my radar. Mm-hmm. But it also comes down to, are the publishers better off starting with the lowest cost edition and working their way up to the highest cost edition over time, or get that high cost collected and then wait over time to get the lower ones? And I see pros and cons to both approaches.
Yeah, no, and you know, for certain properties, you can string it along and try many different things, and other ones you can't, you know, just depends.
Yeah, not all properties are created equal, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I can't see a yearly hardcover Uber Deluxe edition of, say, like the Mosaic series that everybody's forgotten that Marvel published. You know, it lasted 8 issues, so it's not quite long enough, and frankly, nobody cares enough to get an Uber Deluxe hardcover edition of it, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's just a random example.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do think the multiple ways they collect the stuff in it's disincentivizing people from buying anything earlier, and that's one of the things that I think is softened sales to the point that, you know, at the bottom of the top 300, we're below 300 units. It's, oh, well, I want this, but I'll either hold out for that better edition or I'll just get this later.
Yeah, and then there's just so much material that do they remember to get it later? And that's why you just see the attrition in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And then the retailers are, because of the non-returnability, they're only ordering what they reasonably consider to be able to sell. And, you know, you see these, you know, giant number ones, and some of that's the variant stuff, and some of that's the extra discounts that the publishers give. But, you know, you see how much they cut down by issue two or three, because that's what they know they can sell, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, they've got to have enough copies on the shelf of the right stuff that if we want it, we can go in and we can go get it. But they have too much of the wrong stuff on the shelves. It just sits there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the gamble they're taking. And on the trade side, they've at least got the ability to gauge based on the reaction the individual comics had. Mm-hmm. But they're also kind of gambling on what is the long-term outlook on this property. Is it something that's going to continue being published for 5-6 years? Okay, maybe 3-4 years. Let's be, maybe 1 or 2, just to be realistic. Because the longer the thing is in print, the longer there's interest in it, be it in trade, back issues, whatever. Once something has stopped being published, its shelf life starts to you know, evaporate, in some cases to the point of people even forgetting it had been published, much less whether they wanted a copy or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I'm sure I could jump back a year to some of the things being published by Marvel and DC, the big two publishers, and pull up a few examples of things that people have probably just forgotten about. And then it's a question of, well, do you think there's any interest of that material on, you know, in the trade or hardcover format sitting on store shelves? And the odds would be probably not.
Yeah.
But I think that's the big challenge, I think more so on the trade side than on the comic side, ironically, of just the number of properties. Mm-hmm. I think at one point you would have had roughly 300 different properties on the top 300 on the comic side. With the fewer titles and the more frequent shipping, that math has changed. But now I think in the top 300 trade side, well, we've got a few series that are doubling up or whatever. We've got, you know, a surprising number of different properties on the list that, you know, how many people could be considered fans of a lot of this stuff to a serious degree, i.e. interested enough to go buy this.
Uh-huh.
I think they've gotten to the point where the audience is so fractured because of the number of choices out there, it's hard for anything to gain any sort of traction. And if we go with 2,000 or 3,000 stores being out there, most of these items didn't get to every store.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I mean, really, once you're outside of the top 5, the odds of a copy going to every store is, you know, practically zero. It may have gone to 99% of them, you know, whatever, or 50% of them more likely, or, you know, 10%. Because for every store that didn't get one, there's, you know, some stores that would have ordered a half dozen of some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things Brian Hibb had mentioned in one of his articles in Tilting and Windmills, I think it was even one of the earliest ones that was collected into the first trade paperback of his articles, was how he would have liked to have seen Diamond release how many stores did this go out to.
Yeah.
You know, just a percentage basis. What sort of penetration did it get? You know, if you sold 500 copies and it went to one store, that's very different than if it went to 500 different stores. Not necessarily better or worse, but very different.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and, you know, you hear the retailers talk all the time, and, you know, the guys at Cowabunga even mentioned this, you know, for the what they have to pay for shipping, what they have to pay for, you know, when certain, you know, certain amount of comics get damaged in the shipping process, everything, you know, non-returnability, selling a couple title, you know, selling 3 or 4 issues per title is just not profitable, you know, when they have to take in their overhead and everything. You know, that's why series like Batman, when they can sell 50 to 100 copies, that's, you know, that's profitable because, A, they get steeper discounts, you know, because they order more. And so when they have so many, you know, mid-level DC or Marvel titles that sell just, you know, subscriptions plus one or, you know, none subscriptions, that's it, you know, 3 to 4, it's almost like not profitable to have that comic in the store almost, right? But then you're caught because if your reader wants it and you don't satisfy their want, then they go somewhere else. So it's this catch-22.
When I was in college, I worked at a store here in Austin, Texas. And I helped do the pulls every Friday, because that's when New Comic Book Day was back then. And there's a cost to every title that comes into the store, because that's a line item on a pull list. It's a, we would set up these folding tables and stuff and put the comics on them. So you could just pick up the person's pull list, go through, go down the table, grab their items, and then go put it in the filing cabinet where we put their pulls. And if you've got a stack of X-Men that's, you know, 50, 100 items tall or whatever, that's still one stack. Versus if you have 10 other X books, 10 each, that's 10 different stacks, that's 10 decisions. Do I pull this? Do I not? So it's the cost per title, regardless of copies, is very real in a subtle and sometimes very subtle, sometimes very blatant aspect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, if you've got a publisher that's doing four titles and it's boom, they're pretty evenly distributed, you pull, you don't, whatever. Versus, okay, in any given week, you may have easily 100 different stacks of books that you've got to go make a decision, do I pull this for each person or not?
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the, I think, the problems introduced with having so many different books, and you could argue it's better that they've gone to more frequent shipping of less titles, but it's still a lot of titles coming out every week.
Oh, yeah.
And that increased frequency there is why we're seeing an increased frequency here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once a quarter, we're going to be seeing, I mean, we've got X-Men Blue, X-Men Gold here on this list for new material. And odds are the next volumes of that are going to be here before probably in the June numbers.
Yeah, especially, yeah, with that increased publication cadence, you're going to just get more trades. And yeah, it's a good point.
I'm wondering if they're burning out the audience by the more frequent releases and the constant shuffle of titles into these new volumes and just all these decision points a reader has to make.
And, you know, in a lot of ways, that's a problem of their own making, because they keep, you know, on top of that, you know, they keep rebooting things, especially at Marvel. And so we've talked in the past about the behavior of, well, I can just get off this title until they start it over in 3 months or 6 months, because the sales, you know, not that the person walking into the store every week knows the sales, but we know that the sales for some of these things are so, the drops are so big by issue 3 or 4 that, you know, they're not going to get past issue 10 before they have to redo it. And then so that just encourages people getting on and off titles, and it just is, it's a vicious cycle.
Well, they've trained the audience to wait until the next relaunch of the title to check it out again.
Yep.
And that's bad for sales. And at which point, if you're just going to get that whole volume or not at all, why not wait for trade?
Yeah.
There's a lot of things I think these publishers are doing that are not in their best interests. But I don't know how much of that they're doing out of either necessity or either not having thought through the long-term ramifications or not seeing any other options.
Yeah, and I think I almost wonder if, you know, there are certain decisions that DC and Marvel make that, or their bosses above at Warner Brothers and Disney make, that, you know, filters down the line in terms of cost control, or we want to focus on this characters. I mean, look how sidestepped Fantastic Four was so long, because Ike Perlmutter wanted, you know, didn't want to give any oxygen to Fox, who owned the movie rights, right? They were trying to starve that off, and now that they've bought Fox, maybe that'll change. And I think they are, have already solicited, is it, have already solicited a
Dan Slott, right? I think, is the new writer.
I think the artist will be amazing.
But the ramification of that decision,
mm-hmm.
I recently did a web search for Fantastic Four,
mm-hmm.
and pretty much everything that popped up was movie references. I did an image search.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And thinking, well, surely I'll get something of the new title or a comic book stuff. Most of it was movie stuff.
Interesting.
And again, it's almost getting to the point where when Marvel brings it back, they're arguably adapting a movie property, not reviving a comic property.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the point I was going to make is that, you know, DC and Marvel may be making corporate decisions because of their size, but because 80% of a store's business is those two, then the effects and the choices that DC and Marvel make kind of pen and put the other publishers' arms behind their back. You know what I mean? Like, you know, Image, Dark Horse, IDW, they have to operate within the bounds of the direct market in a lot of ways. And if the bounds of the direct market are the general policies that DC and Marvel execute, then, you know, sometimes when we say, well, why don't these other publishers make different choices? Maybe some of their choices are taken away because the, you know, the trends that are developing in the market are driven by the big two.
I think the trends are definitely driven by the big two. And I think a lot of these other publishers are reacting to that, but I don't think it literally takes away their choices in so much as they could buck the trends. They could do something else. They could actually force the hand of Marvel and DC if they wanted to.
Well, I guess, and that is an argument that I think I see you and Sam have sometimes when we talk about, you know, when you and him talk about like variant covers, you know, short-term good, bad, long-term bad, good. And then his view of it, talking to certain store owners and different aspects of it is almost like a separate part of the hobby, like the collectability and the it's almost like a separate thing. Like variant, the people that are mad for variant covers are completely different from the people that read comics for reading comics' sake. And that is it really true that the other publishers make a decision and still make money and still be viable? Because if the other choices is to make is to slowly go out of business because you decided to do something different, is that really a choice? You know what I mean?
It's a choice. It's forced perhaps by necessity, certainly.
Yeah.
But it comes down to me, it's risk mitigation. If you know that most of your sales are because people like the cool cover or whatever, you are placing a certain amount of risk on that interest always being there.
Mm-hmm.
If for some reason the speculator bubble burst and the interest in variant covers were to dry up, and we have seen this before,
yep,
back in the 90s,
mm-hmm,
how many publishers would out of necessity, because they're so reliant on it, go under? Now, let's assume that that demand doesn't go away for print comics, but the demand for print comics goes away and you've got to start moving towards digital. Mm-hmm. If so much of your publishing methodology is based on the collectability, which doesn't really exist as such in digital,
mm-hmm,
you know, people aren't going to buy two digital copies of the same comic for one image.
Mm-hmm.
Just not going to happen, I think. Maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe it would, but I don't think it will. So now they've got to radically go change their whole publishing paradigm to move into the newer technology. So Sam's point of, is there a segment of the audience that just likes the collectability, the chase aspect, whatever? Absolutely. But the question is that the market you want to have your business success hinging on?
Mm-hmm.
And there are times where it's like, hey, I just got to make money. Okay, I get that. That you got to stay in business. You can't win the long game if you're constantly losing the short game and you go out of business. Just doesn't work. But you've also got to have that long game and have something where you're building up that fan base, you're building up loyalty, and not just could you snag the hot artist of the day.
Uh-huh.
To me, it really shows here on the trades list. When we've got some of these things that are doing reorder activity of, you know, 250,000 units or what have you in total, not at once, obviously, that there's something about that property people like and keep coming to and more people come to versus stuff that's a flash in the pan. It may top the list the 1 month and then we never see it again.
Yeah.
It just comes down to what do you want to kind of have your publishing based on?
Yeah, and I guess it depends on what you think is sustainable versus what is, you know, profit-taking at the moment. You know, and if the big two are driven by every quarter needs to have an increase in revenue, you know, they can make self-destructive decisions or, you know, decisions that aren't necessarily healthy. And yeah, it's just something, you know, we talk about in the past, and it's just something to continue to be to kind of be interested in. To me, it just seems like there's so many series that have sales that just don't seem sustainable.
I would agree with that, but there's no reason that they shouldn't be able to have sustainable sales.
Mm-hmm.
We're not in the period of time where there was a stigma against reading comics. It's cool. If nothing else, we should have been seeing a major uptick in sales just from the Hollywood people wanting to check out what they're going to license.
That's true.
Yet we've seen on the top 300 comics side, it constantly fluctuating between like 4.5 million and 9.5 million. And if we were seeing this healthy industry, this growth that people often are talking about, all sales are good, properties are popular, whatever, How come we're not always at the upper end of that range? How come we're not breaking through that range? Why do we have titles that are lasting so short-lived and having to get replaced on a regular basis?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's arguably the most successful time for comic book properties, yet it's clearly not one of the most successful time for comic books.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
And even if stores are doing well, let's face it, a lot of their income is not based solely on the comic stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
And nor should it be, given how volatile the market is.
Yeah, I mean, the guys at Cowabunga, one of their primary reasons for, they're moving their store is, you know, a big part of it is the parking lot, but a big part of it is expanding their gaming options, you know, gaming and their square footage that they can devote to that.
A lot to be said for community building.
Mm-hmm. So.
Now, just going back to the Earth One trades for, or hardcovers for a second.
Mm-hmm.
That Teen Titans Earth One hardcover volume 2, it came out in August 2016. 6,222 units, and has never been on the trades list since.
Huh.
So it comes down to, are they doing really well or not, versus some of these things like that Superman Earth One hardcover that came out back in 2010.
Uh-huh.
It's been on the list 27 times. So long-term interest in the property, continued sales, there's a lot to be said for that. And you can't really do that if you're constantly relaunching your titles, shuffling your creators, changing your takes on the characters, going in bold new directions, or going back to legacy, or having a rebirth, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
You gotta give the property some time to find an audience and get some legs under it.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting time to be in comics because, you know, over the next 10 years or so, you're going to have a certain amount of the old timers going away, and it's a lot of the industry, maybe longer than that, you know, 10, 20, who knows? I just think that in the future, will the new buyers that are coming into comics now, will they be interested in the sustained hobby, or will it just be kind of dipping in and out for the things that they are interested in? And then is that sustainable for the market?
I think to answer that question, we would need to know how by age groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I would almost break it down to a calendar year by calendar year birth date kind of a basis.
Mm-hmm.
Do older people tend to stay on titles longer? Do younger people tend to jump around titles more often? How much of that is an age thing? How much of it is younger readers being more likely to be either digital or trade versus individual issue? And what percentage of the sales are we seeing on this list and the comics list reliant on which age groups? And as those people get older, do they age out of comics for one reason or another, either because they just don't live forever or something like that? And how does that impact things?
Mm-hmm.
Because I definitely could see where there will come a point where the millennials are the largest demographic of the audience, and they're just gonna buy differently than an older age bracket. They're gonna be more likely to be on trades and digital, is my suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, could see the point where trades just kind of fall off, because, well, why get a print copy? You know, by that point, the comic side could be completely dead, too. Who knows? Or is there going to be a retro kind of thing kick in and somehow magically, you know, these really expensive single issues at $4 or $5 a piece or more have a resurgence? You know, I think the likelihood of that's pretty small. You know, it's just, it doesn't have the cost-benefit return versus getting a full story or whatever. And I think digital has the potential of getting the industry much more to a meritocracy of, this was a good issue, so I will buy the next.
Mm-hmm.
But some of that also comes down to frequency of release, of, I can only buy the next if it's available right now. If it's not, I've got to remember I want to buy the next.
Yeah.
Can they sustain that interest? It's definitely an interesting time for comics because we're seeing some shifts happening in the powers at Marvel, and Chris Ryles left IDW. He's going to move over to Skybound. So we're seeing some other stuff behind the scenes. With Boom and Dynamite becoming premier publishers, that may impact stuff. It may not. Certainly with DC moving out to its own catalog, that has, I think, a large potential of changing things somehow. There's just a lot of change happening. But what I'm not seeing is that change being reflected in a sales benefit or kind of a industry health benefit in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
Much like 10 years of wildly successful Marvel movies hasn't really helped Marvel comic sales.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's just, there's so much to think about whether all that stuff, whether all the movies and all the TV shows have just made it less stigmatized to read comics, and therefore, the next 10, 20 years, there will be the potential market for comics and graphic novels will be just bigger because there's not stigma, and then will you be able to see that translate into sales, and how would you measure that? So there's just all kinds of things with that, we just don't know.
Well, it's funny because I think there's less stigma around reading comics, but also less incentive to read them.
Yeah, it's true, because of the material that if you can get your fix just by watching the TV shows and the movies, and Lord knows that there's enough TV shows on to fill your day. But the
I mean, there was a period in my professional career where the fact that people knew I read comics as well, that's just weird. Versus another period not too long ago where there was a company trivia contest going on one Friday afternoon.
Uh-huh.
And I had at least two of the C-level executives of the company call me, recruiting me for their team. And that second guy was none too happy because I'd already gone with the first. But it was one of those, it's going to be movies and comics and stuff. This guy knows the stuff. Turns out it was, I think Geeks Who Drink or whatever. There's some company or organization that does these sort of trivia contests. And when they were talking like Star Wars versus Star Trek, they really meant George Lucas versus Gene Roddenberry. How much you know about the creators of it. So when they were talking comic book stuff, they were really talking, a step or two removed from that. So I was not as useful as I would have liked to have been. But personally, I think trying to answer trivia contest questions around comic books is almost a no-win situation, because the question's going to be, who were the original X-Men? And the answer depends on, well, for which continuity and what perspective?
Uh-huh.
But, yeah. I mean, the coolness around the properties is there. It makes people more interested in knowing the backstory or learning about it, but they're more likely to do it by asking a coworker like myself than going and reading the comics. And the people that I know that are in kind of that mass audience that are reading the comics are doing it through things like the digital comics subscription service Marvel has, where for $5 or $10 a month, they can read as much or as little as they want, and that's it. So subscription model, I think, is what is likely to become the next major dominant revenue stream, but we're probably 5-10 years away from that.
Yeah, no, I can see that. And then some of that will just be as the audience ages, unfortunately, as the older audience dies off, this audience, like, I don't know if you have any extended family with small children, but small children in today's world are so adept with iPhones and iPads or Android equivalents. They're so good with the technology that the barrier to entry for a lot of the older people is they don't like interacting with the screens for the digital comics. That's completely gone in anyone who's under 20. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's no hesitation for people that are basically from teens and up now to a certain age in using technology to access content. It doesn't matter. Like, so many people, they have Apple has those commercials where a little girl is running around on an iPad and someone asks her what she's doing on a computer, what she's doing. And she goes, "What's a computer?" You know what I mean? There's just this complete generational shift in that the technology is just an access point to the content, regardless of its movie, TV shows, music, books, comics. It's just access. It doesn't matter. You know what I mean?
Well, and again, that's one of the big potentials for the marketplace is every one of those devices is now a potential comic store for people who want the material.
Mm-hmm.
And it may just be as simple as at the beginning and end of every Marvel and DC or comic book based movie, this is based on stories that are available to you right now in your pocket with your phone. Check this store out and go learn where these characters originated from or where the story continues, or get a little bit more information on the story you're about to watch or just watched on the movie screen.
Mm-hmm.
I think not everybody's going to partake of that, but we don't need everybody to. We literally need like half a percentage point to do it, to like double sales on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I did the math at one point when the Iron Man DVD came out, and if 0.5% of the people who bought that during the opening either week or weekend had bought the next issue of Iron Man, it would have doubled in sales. So the numbers are in our favor here in terms of growing the industry, and the interest is out there. It's just a matter of finding that percentage or two of people that are actually wanting to read and hooking into them.
Yeah. I just, you know, well, let's hope that it goes smoothly, right? Cross our fingers.
Absolutely. And I think certainly the item that's going to go do it is going to be the one at rank 148, that $500 Infinity Gauntlet box slipcase set or whatever hardcovers that did 530 units, which is astounding at that price point. And it was the number two retail ranked item for the month.
I am astounded at that as well, because if you think about it, when I go into my local LCS at the beginning, when trades and hardcovers are in, they are cover price. And I cannot imagine anyone with access to the internet who would pay cover price for that, because it is literally at least 30 to 40% off on Amazon. And it is, when it first came out, I think it was 50% off at in-stock trades. So the idea of paying full retail for that is brutal. So then, but at the same time, when you're a retailer, if you're going to invest the money because it's non-returnable in that, I would be so afraid of someone not buying it and me just getting stuck with it. You know what I mean? Like, it's just it's terrible.
Well, if $500, sales tax where I'm at is, I think, 8.25%. So full retail plus sales tax, that'd be $541.25 for me. That's about what I pay for comics for a month through Cowabunga Comics.
So just if I was a retailer and knowing how easy it is for people to order stuff online and knowing, I mean, it takes 12 seconds to type it into search for Google for pricing. I mean, they must have very loyal customers, and maybe the store said, look, I can't give you 40% off like Amazon, but maybe I can give you 25. And they, you know, cause Marvel does do solid discounts for things. So maybe the retailer agreed, you know, only for people that absolutely were going to get it. Obviously, like, you would never order that hoping you could sell it. I would hope.
Well,
unless you're Midtown Comics and it's a rounding error on your monthly order, but you know,
something, yeah. But to me, that's why a lot of this is all about risk mitigation.
Yeah.
And it's a substantial risk for a consumer to plunk down $500 for a single item at a comic store.
Yeah.
Certainly there are going to be people who do it and love it and are happy with it, and that's cool. But there are going to be a lot of who are going to look at the price and say, really? Wow. And either shop elsewhere or don't get it. But it comes down to, the higher the price point is, the more higher threshold you've got to get that consumer past to get them to buy it, and the more risk that's on the retailer and such. And I really think longer term, particularly if things go digital, there's going to be a drive towards lower price points and getting stuff to that 99-cent price point for a comic or whatever, but hopefully having a fulfilling installment of the comic and not just a couple of pages. You know, you've got to make people feel that it's so little money that they don't have to give it a lot of thought, and that they got such a good return on that investment that they don't give the next purchase a second thought.
Yeah, it's true.
But not the direction we're heading in. So if we look at the price points, we've got $14.99, $19.99, and $9.99, and $16.99 is the popular price points. $14.99 winning out just by a hair. And then we've got everything again from that $500 all the way down to $9.99 was the lowest in the top 300. Yeah. There was a few items a little lower than that in the top 500. I think $7.99 was the lowest price point there. But most of what we've got, I think, is in the almost three quarters of the list is in the $20 or less category.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a staggering amount. If you were to have bought all of it, it would total up for the top, actually 502 items, since there was that five-way tie at rank 500. It would have cost almost $11,000. I think $10,879.74 if you got it at full retail price. But let's face it, if you're buying that much, get a good deal from your retailer.
Yeah, let's hope that you.
Or become a retailer.
Yeah, right.
that's a lot of money right there, and that's, I think, part of why we're seeing the retailers having to pick and choose so much. They simply can't afford to support most of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even if you were to filter out the reorder activity, you still wind up with a total net cost at full retail of $5,943.62.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've got to tell your retailer what you want. You've got to assume this stuff's not always going to be available. It does go out of print, and that You know, the more you want it, the more you got to tell your retailer, hey, go get this for me.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think it does that. That does it this month.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or excuse, 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as we know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.